What is your fate, sir? Have you, do you know?
Only God knows our destiny, yours and mine.
To die in bed, maybe.
One day, this is going to happen to each and every one of us. The question is what we will have accomplished by then in this transient world, and whether we'll have enjoyed our life.
Was Putin philosophizing about life and death as a leader? Your sense of how he approaches the possibility of possible assassination?
Well, I think he has a very Russian philosophical view. I was kidding him about Dostoevsky, but you know, when you've been the leader of a vilified like you have, and you have Chechen terrorists trying to kill you, and you know, Syrians now, it's not easy to run this whole thing every day. He doesn't know what's going to happen. The United States may do something again very provocative.
Well, he, like the U.S., is also killing Syrians. I think the U.S. now led coalition has surpassed Russia, but they have both been, to say the least, complicit.
I don't want to get off topic, but basically, you know, the bombing, the Russian bombing on the roads against the trucks really destroyed the foundation of the ISIS empire, which is money and oil and shipping through Turkey. He got to the base. Obama bombed for, what, 3-4 years, didn't achieve anything. He talks about running 100 sorties a day. The Russians were intense. It seemed to stop the flow, the momentum. As to terrorism,
seconds.
You know his feelings, because he comes from a background where there's been a lot of it in Russia.
We have to leave it there.
Okay.
But we're going to do a post-show, and we'll put it online at democracynow.org. Oliver Stone, 3-time Academy Award-winning director and screenwriter. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month we'll show the film Body and Soul, An American Bridge, on Thursday, June 15th at 7 p.m. The 1930s tune Body and Soul, composed by Jewish songwriter Johnny Green, it was first recorded as a jazz piece by Louis Armstrong. Filmmaker Robert Phillipson goes in-depth to examine the song's timelessness and its role at the heart of both Black and Jewish music. Again, that's Body and Soul, Thursday, June 15th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What lies before me? The future's coming. Winter that's gray and old.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Pedalpalooza Become the Media Outreach Ride, Sunday, June 18th, from 2 to 4 p.m., starting at Holiday Park in Portland. This Pedalpalooza ride visits the independent media sites of Portland, including KBOO, Freeform, the IPRC, Open Signal, and more. On this ride, you'll learn about how to become part of the independent media movement and explore the opportunities to join our media outlets together. Again, that's Become the Media Outreach Ride, Sunday, June 18th, from 2 to 4 p.m., starting at Holiday Park at Northeast 11th and Holiday Streets in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
As a man travels, there are songs that are sung to him. That he have a safe journey to where he's going and return home safe, all as one. Ayeng, 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 ho. Junandaye, Junashaye, Besinani, Benandaye, Gaye, 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 Aye, aye, junanda ye ho, juna shaye gaye ho, juna kaye gaye. Aye, 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 aye ho, aye, aye.
And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Community Radio. This is Wednesday Talk Radio, and I'm your host, Paul Rowan, and I'm with my co-host, Jacqueline Keeler. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning.
And that was, of course, A. Paul Ortega, who left us last month. And I'm just going to read from the liner notes here. In the early 1960s, Mescalero Apache musician A. Paul Ortega created a sound that forever revolutionized the landscape of Native American music. A respected medicine man, he effortlessly fused Native American healing traditions with the gentle strum of guitar, the stomp of bass drum, and the mournful cry of harmonica. With blues-tinged vocals and storytelling that draw upon Native culture, two worlds and three worlds, his albums that he put out back in the 60s when he was in Chicago, I believe relocated there, not positive about that, have gone on to become modern classics of contemporary Native American musical expression and were soundtracks for many Native Americans, because I know that because when I got involved with people in the Native American community, well, people were still listening to Paul Ortega in the 80s and probably even to this day. So that's out on Canyon Records, of which itself has been instrumental in bringing Native American music to a wider audience. So we have two guests this morning. You want to introduce our guest, Jackie?
Yeah, we have Christine Nobis, who is from Indigenous Iowa, and she is, I think, one of the founders of the Little Creek Camp there, the No-Dapple Camp in Iowa. And we have Desiree Kane, who is a Miwok journalist who lived at Standing Rock at the at the Ocheti Shakowin camp for several months. And and we're going to talk about the recent leaks in The Intercept and other outlets about Tiger Swan and its activities, its COINTELPRO PSYOPS activities that are coming to light now and being affirmed and confirmed. So that's what we're looking at today.
And let me just say good morning individually so people can distinguish your voices, if possible. Good morning, Desiree.
Hey, good morning.
And good morning, Christine.
Good morning.
So let's kick it off. So we haven't been talking about the Dakota Access for a while. It had a very intense trajectory. Many thousands of people got involved. It got massive international attention at the end after getting very little attention at the beginning. There was massive militarized police crackdown. There was many arrests. There was people seriously injured. There's people seriously traumatized. And the aftermath continues. And of course, there is continued resistance in Iowa. So we're going to be talking about a number of those things, including these revelations. So start it off.
Yeah, I guess I'd maybe I will maybe I, it's a recently come out. The Intercept published a couple of articles in late May showing leaked documents that reveal counterterrorism tactics used at Standing Rock to defeat the pipeline insurgencies. And in these, it shows they had definitely infiltrated the camp and were creating a lot of mayhem and trying to pin it on water protectors, and have actually some of them have actually infiltrated the Iowa camp as well and other camps. Christine, would you like to speak to about this a bit?
Would you like me to speak about my experience at Standing Rock or my experience founding Little Creek Camp?
I guess both, and also, you know, what these new revelations about what the what Tiger Swan was doing mean to you and to your work.
Well, I don't really find them revelations. I mean, at all. I expected this. In fact, I've kind of made my peace with the fact that I'm here on a green card. I'm Canadian. I'm Plains Cree Salto of the George Gordon First Nation in Saskatchewan, so I've sort of been prepared, I guess you could say, for surveillance and for the possibility that these larger organizations in the United States might not be happy with what I'm doing. However, I myself have never directly participated in any nonviolent direct action, and have only ever, I guess, call myself an organizer. So that's, and like I said, this is not a revelation to me. When I was at Standing Rock, I actually had a few friends that were very deeply involved with the organizing of actions, and informed me that they knew that, and the NSA was there, and that they were being, you know, surveyed very closely and followed all the time. I myself was followed in Iowa when I was at the Mississippi Stand Camp, which is, I think it was dismantled in November 2016. I was there with, I guess, a more prominent figurehead in the movement from Standing Rock, who was down there to help us. And we were followed for quite some time. And, you know, I just, what could I say? I mean, that's just part of what we do, right? We're considered eco-terrorists, so I guess it comes with the territory.
Was the Dakota Access issue what brought you across the border initially?
No, I've been living in Iowa for 10 years. Mm-hmm. I came here to get my master's degree and to continue to stay in Iowa for my children and my family.
And so the can you describe a little bit about the Little Creek Camp there in Iowa?
Absolutely. So it was something that came to mind back in October 2016. I started going to Standing Rock in August 2016, and made subsequent visits in an attempt to communicate with leadership and organizations about Iowa, because the pipeline fight actually started in Iowa in November 2014, when there was a meeting held by some university students at the University of Northern Iowa who were concerned about this proposed pipeline project. Funny enough, about 200 people showed up at this first meeting, so there was concern from the very beginning in Iowa. And so this fight in Iowa has been going on for almost 3 years, and they used to call it the Bakken Pipeline here because it comes from the Bakken oil fields. And 30% of the pipeline actually is hosted within Iowa, from the northwest corner to the southeast corner. And so to me, it made sense. You know, because there's been over 500 arrests in Iowa concerning this pipeline, because they've been fighting it for so long already with very little media attention, very little funding, that we connect what was going on in Iowa with what is and was going on at Standing Rock. It just seemed to, we needed to make a better alliance because we're fighting the same pipeline. And I guess you could say I see it as a war, and we were kind of this huge movement in Standing Rock that was gaining a lot of attention worldwide and a lot of funding. We could have linked up with them and perhaps done more, which actually did happen. LaDonna actually did help out Mississippi Stand, which was really great. And so what I did, I guess, was to continue to network and communicate, and eventually J.D. Goodhouse and I, he's from Standing Rock, he was one of the announcers. We ended up building, I guess, a network of people that were willing to come down and bring supplies with them when the camp was being dismantled up north. And I ended up finding land, and we ended up opening up the camp on February 26th because we wanted to continue the fight in Iowa, because we can continue to fight in Iowa because of the court case that's going on with the landowners and the Sierra Club that are suing the Iowa Utilities Board over the abuse of eminent domain and the misuse or the mishandling of the permit.
Where is that case at right now?
Right now, it's kind of in limbo. They haven't set a date for they haven't set a date yet, and it's already gone through the initial case, and now it's at the Supreme Court. And yeah, we're basically waiting to hear. It could be months before they actually go to court.
It's must be a lot of conflicted feelings about all this, given that the pipeline is basically constructed and already under operation. This is kind of a question I may be kind of unfair. You may have no way of knowing, but I'm just wondering, are there cases where, you know, large infrastructure projects have already been built and then been stopped?
Well, dams, I guess.
That's true. That's true. They've even been taken down.
Yeah. But in this case, we have been told that if oil is flowing through that pipeline and if these landowners in the Sierra Club are successful, they will have to stop oil from flowing. In order to possibly, we don't know what the outcome could be. We don't know what the judge will rule. However, the judge could actually revoke the permit completely in Iowa.
Really?
I mean, he could. The judge could say that. I don't think so. I think that's wishful thinking. However, there are other scenarios, like the Dakota Access will have to reroute around the individual landowners' parcels, because basically in this sense they would be trespassing.
Wow.
So that could set them back like a year. Some people say up to 2 years. It seems kind of seems a little long to me. However, it is a significant amount of time that they would be set back.
So there's a real chance for a fight there in Iowa to stop DAPL.
Yeah, Carolyn Raffensperger, who's actually one of my heroes and has been fighting this pipeline since the beginning. She's the director of the Environmental Health and Science Network, and she actually has roots in North Dakota and then has been living in Iowa for a while. But so she's the lawyer that's been, one of the lawyers at the forefront of all of this since the beginning. And she's very, she thinks we actually have a chance at winning this court case and a 30% chance. Because the judges, there's a few of them that are more, I guess you could say, liberal. And that's of course, in our case, is good. Meaning that possibly being of a liberal mindset is more concerned. You might be more concerned about the environment and the abuse of eminent domain.
That's excellent. Well, definitely, we want to put up more information about the fight in Iowa. I think that we need a lot more attention to it, and a lot of people are looking for ways to continue to try to stop DAPL and other pipelines that are coming down the road. And we definitely need. Where would you recommend some of our listeners go to learn more about what's going on in Iowa?
We have IndigenousIowa.org. That's the organization that I founded that founded the camp. And then there's our Facebook pages, Indigenous Iowa and Little Creek Camp, and then littlecreekcamp.com. That's our Facebook, our website. And then, of course, we always are looking for funding. However, our camp is a little different. We have a dream of monetary sustainability, where we possibly open up a Little Creek Cafe and serve indigenous food and sell what we're doing, like whatever it is that we're making and growing. Our camp is a little bit more, unfocused. Though we're still fighting a pipeline, we're also looking at other issues like Monsanto, and we also join in other, social injustice issues. We help other organizations. We also are a healing camp, and we're trying to build a sustainable community as well.
Great. How many do you have at the camp?
At the moment, very little, actually. We've had up to about 30. Usually we've had about 20 to 30. At the moment, we have about like 5 to 7, just because it's like, everything kind of, it's up and down. Mm-hmm. At the moment, like I'm in Oregon, actually. And then we have quite a few people that are out doing things, like at the summit, the People Summit. And then, so, but there's always people coming, you know. Supposedly the longest march is coming through, and there's always somebody coming, and there's always somebody going.
Great. So I'd like to bring Desiree into the conversation right now. And Desiree, are you still there?
Hey.
Hi,
Jackie.
So,
hey, Christine.
So we wanted you to talk a bit about having about the impact that Tiger Swan had and how it's affecting water protectors today, dealing with the different PSYOPs activities that happened at camp and how water protectors are struggling with the after effects of that.
But first, maybe say who Tiger Swan is.
Okay, go ahead. You can, and maybe, yeah, Desiree, go into who Tiger Swan is.
Sure, okay. So a lot of people have heard of the mercenary army called Blackwater that reached national attention a few years ago. There are other entities like that. So it's basically a private army force that then contracts with the government or corporations, but because they're private, they don't have the same federal oversight that our armed forces do. So Tiger Swan is one of the many agencies that Energy Transfer Partners, the owners of the Dakota Access Pipeline, hired to do a number of things. Firstly, to try and disband the movement, both externally and internally. So they were responsible for a lot of, the surveillance, strategy and things like that, the documents that Jackie referenced early in the show that got leaked on The Intercept basically show the inner workings of how this mercenary army hired by Energy Transfer Partners planned to and affected some of their work in our space that was really actually horrific and traumatic. So you hear about things like counterintelligence professionals or COINTELPRO for short. You know, you hear about things like this in the movies, infiltrators, people who, you know, are essentially spies going into a place to like disrupt something. But, you know, in the movies, it's way different because what they did was that some of those very things, like with our lives, a number of psychological warfare tactics were inflicted upon many of us that were at that camp. In fact, if anyone was at the camp, they were probably a recipient of it in some form or fashion, but because these are professionals, a lot of people weren't able to identify it. So that's who Tiger Swan is. It's a lot. We've had a pretty negative impact. There's veterans who come back from war have difficulty with mental health issues and PTSD and, you know, the lasting effects of going to war. Well, we didn't go to war. We had war waged upon us being unarmed indigenous people fighting for water. So if you think about this power dynamic, you know, in these documents we're being compared to jihadists who, you know, are well-armed and and yet here we are out there standing with our signs, you know, saying water is life. And as many followed in the national and international news, our community was completely brutalized. People had their arms like basically blown to pieces. And, you know, Vanessa Dundon, also known as Susie Despa, was hit in the eye, lost a lot of vision in her eye. And we don't have the same support services to help hold those lasting effects after having had war waged upon us. So I'm sorry to report that we've had multiple suicides in the broader water protector community. People are experiencing things like homelessness. Myself, I have PTSD, like a PTSD, which makes things really hard. And the lack of media attention anymore, I believe, has left many feeling discarded And now that we're not out there with our bodies being like physically brutalized in front of, it's lost now on what's going on with our bodies, which is equally as painful and longer lasting. So yeah, it's a lot.
And I know that it was that you recently received news just the other day about the loss of another water protector from suicide, and I know that you're dealing with that right now. And are there any support? You said there are no support systems right now. How are water protectors supporting each other now that the camp is gone?
Mm-hmm. So in the very short term, because we are now responding to a crisis, I mean, we've had two people who have taken their own lives in 10 days. Both of them, you know, water protectors, known at camp, on teams. You know, I knew one of them who was on a team that I was on, just for like organization of camp. And so in the short term, there is a group of us women that are all banding together to figure out what's going on, because women do hold the large majority of emotional work, both in American society and in the water protector community. So we've all banded together, pooling resources, trying to figure out like how do we respond. So there'll be a couple of campaigns that get rolled out aimed at Indigenous youth, at the water protector community at large, one specifically focusing on men, because it was a largely male-dominated situation, especially towards the end when it started getting really cold. But there's also obviously women's networks, so there's a focus on making sure that because it was a male-dominated space, that there aren't women that fall through the cracks as well. So some of the things people are experiencing, in addition to PTSD and homelessness, is propensity to deal with untreated things with substances, particularly alcohol, and trying to respond to those things as a public health crisis that we're having in our community. So that's happening. We do have some support systems that have already been loosely established. There's a Facebook group called Healing the Waters Within, like Water Protectors Emotional Support Group, where people who are willing to provide that sort of care are there. And unsurprisingly, that's got a whole lot of really kind and understanding veterans who have been to war and get it. You know, so those sorts of things are happening, but we really can't build these structures fast enough, and it's difficult for the organizers because we're dealing with a lot of those things as well, but we can't abandon our community and our commitment made to organize that space. So we do need assistance. We do need help from the broader mental health community, if anyone listening is able to provide that.
And where would they be able to get in touch?
That's kind of the hard thing. I'm just going to say on my website, DesireeKane.com, I have a contact me form. Because we're in this informal Facebook group for ladies that we're trying to pull it together, we don't have like a formal email to go to yet. It's just DesireeKane.com. There's a contact me form. I kind of want to put my email over there.
Yeah. So the young man who killed himself was himself Native American, and
both were.
Yeah, both were. And certainly Native American youth have the highest rate of suicide. I think that Native American men between the ages of like 16 and 25 have a rate that is 9 times that of their peers already. But this adds to it, the sort of maligning and the meddling of Tiger Swan and their tactics to even kind of criminalize our spirituality. In the documents, they actually try to make a parallel between Lakota Dakota beliefs and how they're expressed in the camp to jihadism, you know, trying to project this idea that Native American the Native American fight for social justice and is akin to trying to really make our spiritual groundings seem completely scary and horrible and so that they can unleash total war upon our people again.
Mm-hmm. They're also doing it from within, Jackie. You and I were talking about a very specific article written by a guy that nobody kind of really knows, wasn't connected to camp, you know, very bizarre narrative of that was trying to essentially be like this one group of people in camp, like they were not what they said, and they were mostly such and such, trying to like pit our camps against each other. And with more closer scrutiny, you know, there are common narratives that Tiger Swan likes to circulate. And so they're messing with us even still by way of creating what I believe are multiple false identities. And then people that said that they were at camp and have some sort of credential, like they're loosely Lakota or Dakota, but don't actually have the community backing them up. And then using like identity politics to try and create inter-camp squabbles even still. And one of the tactics that they stated that they would use was to exploit intertribal conflict between people, you know, just like any massive group of people, like certain people just, you know, are aligned differently, and native to non-native conflict. So Jackie's example of criminalizing our spirituality, you know, that's the external, but, you know, we're also focused on fighting off the internal. They're still messing with us, trying to mess with our community members in between us all. And luckily we're stronger than that, and we can identify it because the documents got leaked and we, you know, were validated with what we already knew was going on. It's intense.
I'd like to just break in and say that you're listening to Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Paul Rowland. I'm with my co-host Jacqueline Keeler, and we have two guests on the phone, Desiree Kane, who spent many, many, many months at the Standing Rock camp, the No Dakota Access Pipeline camp, and Christine Nobis, who is at a continuing resistance camp in the Little Creek camp in Iowa. And we're going to continue this conversation, but coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Intersections Radio, Jennifer Yu, the author of 4 Weeks, Five People, talks about mental health stigma in Asian American communities and the exorbitant cost of treatment. At 9:30, Between the Lines Radio says that Trump's rationale for pulling out of the Paris Accord was based on lies. The feds are moving to impose harsher sentences in drug cases, and California is taking the first steps towards single-payer universal health care. At 10, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Dirtbag answers your gardening questions. And thanks, as always, to our KBOO members for your support, and thank all of you for listening, whether or not you're a member. And if you're not yet a member, you can always become one by going to kbo.fm. and clicking on donate. And this is a talk show, and you are welcome to call in. We do have two lines taken up by our guests, so there will be only one line to call in for this program. And the number is 503-231-8187. I'd just like to ask one question. Desiree, I'm not sure how much you can speak to this currently, but we've been we haven't been talking that much about the sort of aftermath on the Standing Rock community itself. I know we should probably speak to someone from the tribe, but can you speak to that at all?
No, I don't feel like I'm qualified to speak directly about the Standing Rock community.
Yeah, I'll actually be traveling. Desiree and I will both be traveling up to Standing Rock in the end of the month and talking to community members and getting a read on that. So,
I'd like to say one thing about the Standing Rock community. Actually,
yes, Christine.
I would like to say that there are members that are part of that community that are not so concerned about this pipeline.
The reason being is that they already can't drink their water because their wells are contaminated, because, of course, they do not have proper infrastructure within that nation to transport water. And so when I was at Standing Rock, I did speak to a few people that said they weren't concerned about the pipeline because if the pipeline bursts, they still have to go buy their water. So, I mean, this whole movement speaks to a much larger problem, and that being the, basically the deplorable conditions and the mistreatment that Native Americans must go through all over, actually. And I'm talking about indigenous people all over the world, frankly. But that, like, there are people there right now at this moment that are just, they're still not concerned with the pipeline because it doesn't affect their drinking water because they still have to buy their drinking water because their water is contaminated already. Like in Canada, one third of our nations, we are unable to drink the water on our reservations.
Yeah, I think that's, I think most Americans are unaware of how little infrastructure there is on reservations and in Canada and reserves. I grew up, my grandparents are Navajo, traditional Navajos, and in Cameron, Arizona, just near the south rim of the Grand Canyon, where, you know, millions of tourists from all over the world come, they didn't have running water when I was growing up. They had to bring all their water in big plastic barrels, and that was just the norm, and that still is the norm in a lot of areas on the reservation, on the Navajo Nation, and I know that at Standing Rock there was this huge issue with uranium, radiation poisoning of the water, and that affected, particularly in the southwestern part of the reservation, there was a lot of birth defects, and that is still an ongoing problem on the reservation. And certainly the desire for mining companies to reopen these uranium mines, which have really poisoned Indian country, is still there. And you can see that going on at Bears Ears, where they're trying to work the Republican government to reduce the size of the national monument in order to reopen these mines, Christine, could you so these new Tiger Swan documents, you know, a lot of them actually do discuss infiltration of the Mississippi camp, how do you and it sounds really promising, the work that could be done in Iowa to stop DAPL. How do you feel about how it will affect your work in Iowa?
It won't at all. I mean, they've already been intimidating some of my friends and allies. But I mean, what can they do besides follow us around and document what we're doing? And basically, we're not doing anything illegal in Iowa because our campaign is a different one. We are not involved in anything illegal. In fact, we're doing, we've created what I would call like a political campaign that we want to use to incite the public to activate Iowans to see what is going on right within their vicinity, with how corrupt their Iowa Utilities Board is, and to educate them on what the devastating effects this pipeline could possibly have in a state that is primarily relies on agriculture. So we are more about education and change at a level that doesn't involve direct action. And of course, as you said, or somebody stated earlier, the pipeline is complete in Iowa. So right now we're working at a different level. I like to call our camp a think tank. We're looking into different ways of making change. I mean, I always say, I'd like to start an investment group one day. We're also, showing people like how you can live sustainably. And so I'm not worried about Tiger Swan at all. In fact, I'd invite them into our camp if they wanted, and I'd give them a tour. And the other thing I want to say about Tiger Swan is, I guess I'm an educated Indigenous person, So I know what these people have been doing, like this, our government and these private entities and these colonial settlers, they've been doing this to Native Americans, you know, since they stepped foot on this continent. You know, identity politics, you know, putting natives against Native nations against Native nations, you know, even setting up scenarios where natives, you know, are made to look guilty for something that white people did. You know, sometimes I wonder, you know, even in the case of my boyfriend, Thomas Bettles, or like Thomas Touches Lightning, or Lakasha, which you two are very familiar with. Sometimes I even wonder if that the, you know, the rape allegations that were put against him, if that was Tiger Swan, you know.
Well, they so do in the the leaked documents say that the that those trucks that were set on fire and that so much footage, news footage was taken of, was actually done by Tiger Swan operatives.
Absolutely, but I mean, I think it could go as like I said, as intricate as, you know, getting in there and having somebody even, you know, cry wolf. For like these sorts of allegations, you know, it's not just about destroying equipment. It's not just about like leaking information. You know, it could be as unsettling as trying to defame or like ruin somebody's reputation.
Well, we know that
that level.
We know that the FBI engaged regularly in that sort of thing against American Indian Movement, against the Black Panthers and other groups in the 1960s. It looks like, you know, this privatization of these functions is going apace. So now we've got these huge paramilitary quote security firms like Tiger Swan engaging in similar tactics that the FBI sort of pioneered, or I'm sure they've been going on even long before that. But yeah, this whole the extension of the war on terror, you know, which obviously, as you quite rightly mentioned, began on this continent from day one, but the current war on terror, you know, that people think of as going on around the world, has obviously been completely integrated into, you know, the domestic scene here in so many different ways. It's seems like that was
we've never been the terrorists, but we've been considered the terrorists since the beginning. I mean, Desiree was speaking about the criminalization or the, I guess, painting a very ugly picture of our own spirituality and our religious practices. I mean, that is not new to me. That is not new to any Native American person that is aware of our, you know, even a little bit aware of our history. I mean, that's what missionaries did from the very beginning. They pit us against each other. They pit, you know, Catholics and Protestants, even themselves, against each other to basically paint a picture of savagery. You know, to make our belief systems look violent and basically evil. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, like I said, I guess I might be a jaded person and or just somebody that is just aware of like what's been going on for hundreds of years. And so Tiger Swan doesn't mention me at all. Tiger Swan is just the norm.
Yeah. Well, you know, the High Plains Reader also came out with reporting earlier this last week, and from a former Tiger Swan employee who confirms that Tiger Swan was very involved, that the employees were given bonuses for instigating any kind of violent activity with the water protectors. The head of Tiger Swan really worked with the law enforcement directly and encouraged them to really penalize water protectors with really high fines and ridiculous, outrageous charges, which are going through the courts now, and many of them have been dismissed. So it's this idea of, you know, go ahead, sorry.
Oh, no, I'm agreeing. I mean, we had $5,000 bonds, or bail, I mean, sorry, in Iowa for a couple of water protectors, for instance. So yeah, I understand that.
Yeah, it's been basically to harass and to criminalize, exercising your First Amendment rights and to free speech, And this has been ongoing in many states where they have been advised by North Dakota and entities like Tiger Swan and how to prevent a Standing Rock in their state. So that South Dakota passed legislation to criminalize many forms of constitutionally protected speech. And so have other states. Has that been going on in Iowa at all, or has the legislature there not taken action on that?
Not taken action on protecting, or are they...
criminalizing free speech.
No.
Yeah, that's good.
Not to the extent that it has been going on at Standing Rock.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, though, that when we went to an Iowa Utilities Board meeting a few months ago, it was the first one that we attended as a camp. I think there was about 3 to 4 Native men and a white man that walked into it holding a sign, and the cops were called right away. So, and this is a public meeting that holds space for people to speak for 2 minutes after the meeting is over so they can testify or just speak their truth about how they feel. And so these people went to this meeting from our camp and they were called immediately. I guess when you have some, you know, no dapple chic dressed people and a Native American walk into a public meeting that they are invited to, you need to call the cops. So in that sense, yeah, I guess there has been some, I guess, criminalization of free speech going on.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I feel like it's in my opinion, that's the first time I've hit happen that quickly.
We're losing you. We're losing you.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. I feel like that had more to do with identity politics, with racism, than it had to do with anybody just thinking that there's some people randomly coming in are going to do something wrong. So... That's my thought on that.
I want to ask you all a question. Is, you know, this whole, so many people pinned a lot of hopes. A lot of people were, you know, on the whole no dapple struggle. A lot of people were educated, some for the first time, some to a much greater extent about, you know, the reality of Indigenous peoples, culture, politics, struggles. A lot more people were educated on the whole issue of pipelines and the fossil fuel industry, you know, and frankly, a lot of people, you know, pinned a lot of hopes on that. It was such an intense moment. It was such a high moment in a lot of ways, at the height of it, that, you know, and then the reverse of the Corps of Engineers decision. It seemed like, you know, there's a real possibility that we were actually going to, you know, defeat a major pipeline. And then, you know, the aftermath has been for people who are at the camp, one thing, you know, the intensity of all that. And then, you know, the various letdowns and the various traumas that were suffered, you know, people who are just visited or people from afar, you know, have their own experience about it. Obviously, we see that, you know, resistance did continue. It went to other pipeline struggles in Florida, I believe in Texas, in Iowa, you know, continuing against the DAPL in Iowa. Then, you know, obviously the KXL pipeline, you know, this thing didn't end. But I was wondering if y'all have any thoughts sort of about sort of the overall, I know this is a huge question, but just how are you feeling about how this has played out and what's, you know, how it's playing out today?
Well, I can say for one, you know, people say, oh, you know, that we didn't win up there. And I just reject that whole idea, because one of the things that I learned was that there's a community of people that will show up when you throw the red flag up for certain issues. And what we won in North Dakota was not only all these different Native nations coming together to form a place like like no other, where for once we implicitly were able to understand each other. So there was a lot of healing there. You know, there are some things that are I call it old pain, you know, and so being around so many other people that were attuned to like what that feels like, what the boarding school systems did, like what loss of language, loss of certain things, criminalization, all these things, what that felt like without having to first explain it was incredibly healing. And so we identified each other on a level that we hadn't before, because, you know, just like with any other community, Native people, we don't all share the same belief set, either politically or spiritually. And so what I found to be helpful was I found the Native community that stands against pipelines that was helpful for me. So we didn't lose that. And we didn't lose things like, now Christina and I know each other as well. And the fight has done that for a lot of people, right? The fight up around Standing Rock was something that catalyzed a lot of people. There's a camp now in Oklahoma that's going up. There are multiple camps in South Dakota that are opening. You know, people are gearing up to fight in the Black Hills again, because what Standing Rock and that fight, the legal underpinnings and the moral underpinnings are around honoring the treaties. You know, in the Black Hills, there's a treaty battle there too. So a lot was learned about ourselves and our community and what we can accomplish. And a lot was learned about, like, you know, the day that President Obama signed a document halting the Dakota Access Pipeline for a moment, he signed in two other pipelines. So, like, it is an uphill battle. But now we're starting to understand, like, not only what works, but what doesn't work. And, you know, any, like, self-reflective adult knows that there's value in understanding what not to do in the future. I mean, we just gained so much knowledge, and like, there isn't loss in that at all. So this fight obviously continues in Iowa. Energy Transfer Partners is big and bad, and that's what was going on with the Texas camp. Energy Transfer Partners goes all the way down to the Gulf, so there's a fight in the Gulf to be had that's waging now. You know, the visibility around these bad corporate actors has definitely been elevated as well, because, like, you know, we talk about, oh, corporate power is bad for people. Well, now we have tangible examples. Hmm. You know, like, look what happened at Standing Rock. That was, like, the largest, most historic social movement since the Civil Rights era, like, in the last 50, 60 years. Hmm. So it's just, like, we didn't lose that fight at all. In fact, I would argue that right now, you know, things are hard and we do have some community struggles, but that fight up there strengthened the community's resolve, because now we know that we're not as alone as sometimes we may feel.
True. What do you think, Christine?
The same sentiment, actually. People say to me sometimes, what did you learn from Standing Rock by their mistakes that is helping you make your camp more successful? And I always say, well, I don't think there were mistakes at Standing Rock. I mean, I do think that there were mistakes on the part of the Morton County Sheriff, you know, DAPL Security and Tegra Swan and the, you know, the NSA and the government at large. However, I don't think that any of the water protectors, any of the indigenous people and our Standing Rock itself, I don't think that, like, we made mistakes on our side. I think that we just, I think we just did stuff. I think we tried. I think we created, well, like Desiree said, we were catalysts for future endeavors. We've inspired people. What happened there was something that was meant to happen so that more could happen because of it. It's a movement now. And it's a global movement, I think. And I think that with the right dedication, with the right amount of people that want to sacrifice and dedicate themselves to this movement, I think that we could do a lot.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I am, my father's Yihongtuan Dakota, and my Aunt Faith's Bodigo was an elder at the camp at Standing Rock, and my grandmother's family is from Mokpala on Standing Rock, and talking to my aunt, she talks a lot about how these are prayers in our beliefs. These were prayers that were put forward at Wounded Knee in 1890, and with the Ghost Dance, and that these are prayers that have been carried all these generations, and that they are coming to fruition now, and that when we put the call out, that so many of our relatives from across the world and other indigenous nations came to help us help the Dakota Lakota people was pretty amazing, and it shows the power of that connection, of that prayer, and she often says that these prayers, you know, they don't operate on human time, and so it's I think that there is a lot, I think that there was a sort of spirit to what happened, and that comes out of the land and comes to from our relationship to it, and so I'm pretty hopeful, and I thank you, Christine, for your work to continue that fight in Iowa, and I hope that we can do whatever we can to continue to support it and bring more attention to what could actually have a huge impact on DAPL. And Chris and Desiree, I really thank you for your strong compassion and your sense being there for these for so many water protectors who are in desperate need right now, who are really suffering and who have been forgotten in a sense. Everyone expects everyone to go back home, go get on with their lives. But this was a momentous occasion, and there was also, it was a war, and many of our friends and family who took a stand there are suffering, and I thank you for bringing that, reminding us of that all the time.
Certainly. Yeah, we need those prayers.
Well, I just want to, we're going to have to wrap it up here in a second. Just to re-mention some of the contact information there for the Christine Nobis and the her work there in Iowa, indigenousiowa.org and littlecreekcamp.com. Also, Facebook pages connected to those. And for Desiree Kane, Desiree, DesireeKane.com. You can link up to what she's doing. I want to thank you two both. And I just want to give Jacqueline an opportunity to talk about you're having a reading coming up, right? Edge of Morning?
Yes. Yeah. I have a book that just came out this month from Torrey House Press called Edge of Morning, Native Voices Speak for the Bear's Ears. And when we're having our first local book reading at Annie Bloom Books on June 19th on Monday. And I invite you all to come out to it.
And where is that?
Annie Bloom Books.
Where do you know where? Oh, you don't have that information right off hand. That's all right. Sorry.
Yeah, you can. It's on Annie Bloom, Annie Bloom's Facebook page. They have an event page for it, and so.
And of course, that issue's heating up again because there's an effort to get Trump to reduce, not to eliminate it, but to reduce the size of it by probably quite substantially.
Yeah, Zinke, the U.S. Department of the Interior secretary. Issued a recommendation to President Trump to reduce the size of Bear's Ears. And this is specifically to, you know, out of pressure from mining companies, particularly uranium mining companies. And of course, Native communities have paid a huge price. Those mines are often not cleaned up and poison the water and harm future generations.
So that's something we haven't heard much about, the uranium there. We've heard, we've talked about on the show the issue of the looting of those amazing treasures there.
There's 110,000 archaeological sites in the Bears.
But there's also uranium. Has there been uranium mining already?
Yes, there has. Yeah. Okay. And so it's So I'll be actually talking about that on Monday at Annie Bloom. I think it starts at 7:00, and
7834 Southwest Capitol Highway. Of course, everybody out there's got computers of their own. Anyway, well, we've only got a minute left. Any last thoughts from our guests, Desiree?
Christine?
I just wanted to say that the most important thing to remember about, for me, about all of this is the word decolonization. Mm-hmm. I mean, I say this over and over again. I feel like a broken record, but it's time for Indigenous people all around the world to stand for their methodologies, their ideologies, and to get those get this put into mainstream society. Make people understand that the Earth is our mother, and that we have to treat her as such. The Earth is not something that we can just do what we want to. You know, we have to change this mindset, this Christian ideology, you know, that, you know, God gave man dominion over the earth. Mm-hmm. And so that's my campaign, is to get that, to empower the Indigenous voice, and to have people understand that there's a different way of thinking.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay, we got to run. Thank you so much to all of you, and thanks for co-hosting, Jackie.
Sure.
It's Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month we'll show the film Body and Soul, An American Bridge, on Thursday, June 15th at 7 p.m. The 1930s tune, Body and Soul, composed by Jewish songwriter Johnny Green, it was first recorded as a jazz piece by Louis Armstrong. Filmmaker Robert Phillipson goes in-depth to examine the song's timelessness and its role at the heart of both Black and Jewish music. Again, that's Body and Soul, Thursday, June 15th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What lies before me? Futures call me. Winter that's gray and old.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Pedalpalooza Become the Media Outreach Ride, Sunday, June 18th, from 2 to 4 p.m., starting at Holiday Park in Portland. This Pedalpalooza ride visits the independent media sites of Portland, including KBOO, Freeform, the IPRC, Open Signal, and more. On this ride, you'll learn about how to be